visited Kabul last week.
The recent political trips of Afghanistan's eastern and western neighbors to Kabul are a proof of importance of the country to them. That is especially at a time when insecurity is on the rise and negotiations are underway between the Afghan government and the Taliban to bring a lasting peace to the war-torn nation. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The Gaza Strip has logged more than 15,000 COVID-19 infections and over 65 deaths, mostly since late August. Since Thursday, around 3,000 infections were detected in the impoverished enclave. Hospitals in Gaza currently have less than 100 ICU beds and ventilators for nearly 2 million inhabitants. 80% of ventilators for coronavirus patients have already been taken up. The World Health Organization cautioned that within a week, the health system in Gaza may become unable to care for critical cases.
The situation is becoming extremely dangerous in Gaza amid rapid increase of coronavirus infections, and people here will continue to suffer. The health sector is already fragile and in a very bad shape because of the Israeli blockade. The health system will soon be unable to deal with the coronavirus pandemic and other health needs.
Despite the increasing number of coronavirus infections, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medical equipment.
Israel has systematically destroyed Gaza's health system and almost paralyzed its ability to provide health services by refusing to allow in vital medical equipment amid the apathy of the international community. Unfortunately, some Arab regimes are normalizing ties with Israel and encouraging it to perpetrate more crimes against the Palestinian people.
Local authorities have been desperately fighting to prevent the devastating outbreak of COVID-19. According to Palestinian officials, the Israeli blockade imposed on Gaza is one of the main reasons why tackling the deadly pandemic is particularly difficult.
The blockade has taken its toll on all aspects of life in Gaza, especially on the health system. The health system is struggling with the logistics, lack of medical equipment, as well as testing kits for the virus and hospital ventilators to keep patients alive.
Rights groups warn that Gaza is facing a catastrophic situation under the watchful eye of the international community.
Experts say Israel's illegal practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians, making it extremely difficult to combat the pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A debate on fundamental rights in the EU has just concluded in the European Parliament. COVID-19 lockdowns and reduced access to services due to the pandemic have apparently made the elderly more vulnerable, and other groups too.
Women, children in poverty, and people with disabilities.
The 27-nation bloc's asylum system was castigated during the debate.
We have migrants left to rot and fester in camps, while boats of pregnant women and children are pushed out to sea by state forces in Greece. We have migrants raped with the branches of trees by state forces in Croatia. We have Muslims hounded in France.
It's claimed the EU's attitude towards refugees is facilitating abuses both within the bloc and in neighbouring countries.
Greece, Turkey, Poland, Belarus, Spain, Morocco, Hungary, Serbia, and in some countries, Croatia, they even face torture, humiliation, and sexual abuse.
Governments in EU nations, such as Czech Republic and Hungary, are fueling Islamophobia by the way they are dealing with the refugee crisis, according to experts.
They've sought to interpret that crisis as a one of Muslim invasion. And government narratives, when they're deployed in that way, can be very strong.
Other fundamental rights abuses in the EU are also being highlighted. Spanish authorities are criticised for imprisoning activists in Catalonia.
We spend all our time asking Hungary and Poland to act like genuine democratic states, but we don't do anything on Spain. Without civil and political rights, the European project is done for.
Some lawmakers accuse the EU of hypocrisy in terms of how it tries to export its values.
Let's just take one example, cozying up to Israel and Saudi Arabia, which have appalling human rights records, while at the same time imposing really tough sanctions against countries such as Russia and Iran. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
cafes, restaurants in Catalonia are back in business after a prolonged coronavirus shutdown that impacted thousands of businesses, pushing angry workers out on the streets in protest. Following a sustained decrease in the daily number of COVID-19 cases, the regional government scrambled to improve a plan to reopen the economy unveiled last week by increasing operating hours and adding concert halls to the list of businesses that can reopen.
We are very happy to be back to work and hope this is the last time we shut down because it will be the end for our business. I cried every day when I was out of work because I have a family to feed. We are worried. We can't fail this time.
Under the new guidelines, food service businesses are able to operate indoors at 30% occupancy, while they can serve at full capacity on terraces, provided they keep a 2-meter distance between tables. The 4-phase reopening is expected to last 2 months, with a gradual lifting of restrictions on movement inside of the Spanish northeastern region. A 10 p.m. curfew will stay in place for several weeks as the situation in hospitals and intensive care units remains critical. Meanwhile, authorities have launched massive antigen testing campaigns across the region in a bid to control the spread of the virus.
The antigen rapid test detects the COVID-19 virus using a nasal swab. It offers a highly reliable result within 15 minutes, and it is one of the most cost-effective tests on the market right now.
Although test sensitivity for rapid antigen testing is generally lower than for the standard PCR, authorities are pushing for their deployment, arguing they could be useful in detecting highly infectious people. With a population of 7.5 million, Catalonia has registered over 300,000 cases of COVID-19 and over 15,000 deaths since the start of the pandemic.
The reopening of the economy in Catalonia is fraught with its fair share of risk and reward for everyone involved. It will take at least 2 weeks to find out if the second shot at the virus was successful. The stakes for the food service, hospitality, entertainment and sports industries have never been higher. Kusai Kadri, Barcelona.
Some 120 kilometers from Srinagar, the summer capital of Indian-administered Kashmir, lies Uri. The line of control that divides Kashmir into two parts and ruled by India and Pakistan runs through this area of Baramulla district of Indian-held Kashmir. After trekking around 10 to 15 minutes, you reach the Smurthal village, which is frequently a target of India-Pakistan animosity. Parvez Ahmed's house was completely destroyed in the recent India-Pakistan face-off. Although his family was lucky enough to survive this devastating attack.
This is not new for the people who live near the LOC. But this time it was a rain of artillery. Years of my toil is wasted. I and my family of five are homeless now in this winter. The fire even burned the food stock that I had stocked up for the winter months.
Weeks have passed since the incident. Parvez is still waiting for help and relief work to begin.
We have repeatedly asked the government to build bunkers for the people living in this area. The government is not paying attention to our needs.
The Jammu and Kashmir administration is working on a project to construct 44 bunkers for people living along the line of control. They said that another project for building some 250 individual bunkers is underway.
Whenever we go to government officials with a request, they often turn us away. Many times they say, go and seek help from Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Whatever is being said about help and relief is a media stunt, a part of which might reach us but too late.
For decades, Kashmiris have been bearing the brunt of India-Pakistan animosity. The two countries have fought two of their three wars over Kashmir, which they rule in parts but claim in its entirety. Kashmir has lost tens of thousands of people after the armed struggle against Indian rule began in 1989. India accuses Pakistan of training and sending fighters into Indian side of Kashmir, something Pakistan denies but says it only supports the idea of free and unified Kashmir, politically and diplomatically. The question that remains is how long will Parvez and many others like Parvez wait for government's assistance? Can they survive this harsh winter without a proper shelter? And how long will it take the world to stand for the resolution of this long-pending dispute without further destruction? Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
As the European Council is set to convene in December to discuss the tensions with Turkey, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has called for dialogue, but warned the EU not to become a tool for enmities during escalating tensions over the Eastern Mediterranean. In his latest statement on Turkey-EU ties, Erdogan said Turkey sees its future in Europe and mentioned Turkey's post-pandemic plans to improve judicial infrastructure and strengthen the economy and other reforms.
We see ourselves as an inseparable part of Europe, with which we share 600 years of historical bonds. We are calling on the EU to create a closer bond with us, to keep the promise of full membership for Turkey. We see ourselves in Europe, not anywhere else. We aim to build our future with Europe.
Observers, however, say Turkey does not stand any chance to become an EU member, despite all negotiations.
In my opinion, the EU does not see Turkey either as a partner or a possible member of the bloc. For the EU, Turkey is only a trade ally. This means that neither now or in future, Turkey will not get closer to becoming an EU member.
Earlier this week, the EU's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, said Turkey isn't sending positive signals and needs to change its attitude fundamentally regarding the hydrocarbon dispute with EU members Greece and Cyprus in the Mediterranean Sea. European leaders say they will watch for Turkey's steps in the next couple of weeks before discussing any potential sanctions in their upcoming summit. Turkey is still a candidate to become an EU member. The bloc decided to effectively freeze accession talks in June 2018 over disagreements on accession terms. Many here are pessimistic about the future of accession talks, despite Ankara's ongoing efforts to meet the EU's demands. Meanwhile, some economists even warn that the accession could harm Turkey's economy. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Israel launched airstrikes in the early hours of Sunday on the Gaza Strip, causing damage to surrounding areas, but no casualties reported. Israel claims the airstrikes targeted Hamas positions and came in response to a rocket fired from Gaza toward the southern city of Ashkelon, the second time in 2 weeks.
Israel is not committed to its responsibilities, refusing to allow in the required ventilators for the enclave amid the coronavirus pandemic. The resistance front preserves the right to give a crushing response to those violations.
The Palestinian groups say they will continue their resistance as long as Israel is imposing its crippling blockade over the impoverished enclave, especially amid the coronavirus pandemic and the shortage of medical equipment and ventilators.
It is the resistance movement's duty to defend Palestinians against the Israeli aggression under any condition. Israel should be held accountable for the deterioration of the Palestinians' lives. This is a crime against Gazans.
Observers say Israel's refusal to meet the basic needs of Palestinians increases the possibility of further escalation.
The ongoing conflict comes as a result of Israel's suffocating siege on the Gaza Strip over the past 14 years. Palestinians won't remain silent. Through strikes like the recent ones, Israel is seeking to cover up its internal problems.
Israel has been conducting similar strikes on Gaza Strip over the past months.
The resistance groups here stress they are ready for any possible escalation, and the resistance will go on until the crippling siege on the Gaza Strip is broken. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
working week.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
گاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the Most Merciful.
the debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. 39 Afghan civilians who were killed in 2002 are most likely to have been killed illegally by Australian Special Forces. Now, this is according to a four-year investigation by Australian Defence Force after complaints by Afghan and Australian nationals to investigate. So what does it all mean now? Stay with us as we take a look at this on this debate.
The Australian military is under fire following the release of a damning report this week that has found credible evidence of war crimes in Afghanistan. The long-awaited report, based on a four-year inquiry, has found evidence that Australian Special Forces killed dozens of Afghan prisoners, farmers, or other civilians. The findings of the inquiry, carried out by the Australian Defence Force, reveal a twisted and extreme warrior culture among the elite of the Australian armed forces who were deployed to Afghanistan. The commandos were supposed to fight militants thousands of kilometers away from Australia, but many of them now stand accused of engaging in a methodical campaign to kill unarmed Afghans and conceal it. In one instance, the inquiry has found evidence that platoon commanders told junior soldiers to get their first kill by shooting prisoners. An academic who carried out initial research into the atrocities believes that they were, quote, deliberate, repeated, and targeted war crimes. The inquiry findings show that some of the soldiers who are accused of committing these war crimes are still serving in the Australian military. The report has been highly redacted, and many details of the atrocities remain unknown. But its authors have admitted that they probably failed to uncover all crimes committed during a period of time under investigation. They have recommended a mechanism to collect and assess further allegations of atrocities in Afghanistan. The findings are deeply embarrassing for the Australian government, which is a vociferous critic of rights abuses around the world. The government initially tried to suppress whistleblowers and local media that had tried to bring the alleged war crimes to public attention. Australian authorities tried hard to keep a lid on this story when it first emerged in 2017. That year, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation published shocking allegations of unlawful killings of unarmed Afghans, including children, based on leaked military documents. The Australian Federal Police raided the office of the national broadcaster and tried in vain to prosecute the journalists who blew the whistle on the killings. The story now seems to have turned into a major scandal. The latest findings are a painful legacy of America's longest war. The U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in October 2001 has resulted in nearly two decades of war. A very large number of Afghan civilians, including children, have lost their lives in American and U.S.-led airstrikes and operations. The U.S.-led military campaign has failed to wipe out militancy. It instead devastated Afghanistan and has left the country grappling with an endless list of problems. The United States itself is being investigated for possible war crimes in Afghanistan. The ICC probe began earlier this year after a preliminary report found reasons to believe war crimes had been committed during the war. U.S. President Donald Trump, who was infuriated by the investigation, imposed sanctions on the court. His decision drew worldwide condemnation. Observers believe that the U.S. must have a lot to worry about as the International Criminal Court investigates its actions during the war in Afghanistan.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, author and lecturer Jonathan Fryer out of London and journalist and historian Brett Yonkers out of Hasselt. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, let's start off in London with Jonathan. What did you think about the findings of this investigation, and were you surprised at all that these type of abuses had taken place?
Obviously, the reports are very shocking indeed, even though it was somewhat redacted. There's enough information in there to really raise huge questions over the whole nature of the operations of the special forces of the Australian Army in Afghanistan. The good thing is the report has come out, and also that the head of the Defence Services has apologised. But of course, an apology is nothing like enough. There will be prosecutions, and there must be prosecutions. But it shouldn't only be the younger soldiers who end up being prosecuted, because I think clearly the command chain goes higher, including perhaps into the political sphere of the leadership in Australia, and there needs to be a very, very careful investigation as to exactly how this sort of policy came about, where, as was mentioned in the introductory piece, for example, there would be what was called blooding. Young recruits just arriving would be told to shoot a prisoner in order to get them used to killing civilians, which is clearly a war crime.
Well, Brett, in the report it states about that war culture that our guest in London just was mentioning amongst these elite troops, and the way some troops were anxious to get their first kill. And what exactly does that say? I mean, does it appear to you that this would just be something isolated, and these troops were not following orders? Do you think this is just isolated with these individuals, or do you think that the responsibility goes further up the ladder?
I think it definitely runs further than just the rank-and-file troops that have committed these atrocities. Indeed, as has been mentioned and as was written in the report, in many cases, these were initiation rituals of a kind. You know, young soldiers, grunts who come into combat for the first time, who are being told to basically get their hands dirty immediately in one of the most gruesome ways possible by murdering either civilians or unarmed prisoners. And, of course, this order had to come from someone. And so this order came most likely from the officers. And the officer staff, of course, responds to an even higher brass of higher officers and higher-ups, that I think it's very unlikely, if this was such a relatively commonplace occurrence, as seems to be hinted in the report, it would be very unlikely that the higher brass did not know about this, and that the military leadership was in the dark about this. I think this is... On the contrary, this speaks to a very typical and very problematic culture of extreme nationalism and jingoism in not just Australia, and not Australia in particular even, but in the Western armed forces that have been active in the Middle East in general and in Central Asia in the past few decades. This is a typical sort of mentality that you see also expressed in the United States military, I believe also in the British military, and in many of the troops that and armies in general, army command structures of the nations that are active in the conflict in, for example, Afghanistan, but also in Iraq. Because what you see is a form of result, what I would call a result of decades of massive propaganda, of dehumanization of the enemy, and not just of the enemy, but of the people living in the country. Mm-hmm. This is no longer crimes committed against people who fought necessarily against this these troops. These are not just Taliban soldiers or Daesh or whatever extremists that are being targeted. These are very often civilians. There have been numerous cases of footage being published in which soldiers, usually American soldiers, are traveling through the countryside in Afghanistan and just murder some farmers or some goat herders or shepherds along the way, because they know that there is very little chance of this really going viral, let's say, because for them these are just illiterate peasants that they mm-hmm. can do with whatever they want. This is a problem of mentality, a problem of mindset that's all pervasive in the military structure of many Western societies.
What about that, Jonathan? I mean, do you think in general this U.S.-led coalition, and in this case we're talking about the Australian side of things, but in general that, as our other guest was alluding to, that they have this superiority type of attitude when dealing with the other, especially, for example, dealing with Afghans, and basically not even looking at these people as human sometimes?
Yes, I'm sure that's right. Brett is absolutely correct to focus on the dehumanization of the other in these sorts of conflict situations. The fact that they're of different ethnicity, the fact that they are Muslims in most cases, also plays into this narrative of some countries, including the United States, that see them therefore as the enemy, whether they are actually armed resistance or terrorists or just ordinary farmers going about their own business. And there seems to have been that such an acceptance of that situation in Afghanistan, by no means only by the Australians, that poor Afghans who were confronted with these sorts of situations often didn't even complain because they thought it would be a complete waste of time, that there was a culture of impunity, and the well-armed Westerners, whether they were Australians, Americans, or indeed British, would always be able to have their way, and that the best way to escape problems was to remain quiet and out of sight. So there is a real problem. And it's not only in Afghanistan. We saw incidents like that in Iraq as well. For example, the way that Americans treated people in Abu Ghraib prison, you may recall, appalling scenes of degradation and dehumanization. And this is something that really Western countries, including Britain, have got to come to terms with and to stamp out.
Well, Brett, the acts that, actually crimes that we're talking about happened 18 years ago. Why do you think it's taken so long to expose this when Afghan families have been complaining from the very beginning about the abuses of U.S.-led coalition forces there?
Well, I think it's a combination of general problems, of course, getting information like this out to the world, but combined with a far more important and far more destructive problem, being the policy of keeping a lid on everything. As has been said in the beginning of the report, indeed, by the reporter on the scene, is that when ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, reported on this in 2017 in the first place, their offices were raided, and the journalist was for a while threatened basically to be treated as, for example, Julian Assange or Edward Snowden were when they basically blew a whistle on certain crimes that were being committed in the country or by people of the country's nationality. So this is when you see that this is how far they will go in broad daylight in Australia already, you can only begin to imagine how far they will go in order to keep this under, to swipe this under the rug when it's being said in Afghanistan. You can imagine if a farmer or a shepherd in Afghanistan goes to complain to the authorities, to the police forces, even if it's the Afghan local authorities, the chances are very high, of course, that this complaint will be noticed by the occupying forces, the foreign forces that are being talked about, in this case, the Australians. So, of course, there is no evidence of a violent crackdown on people who are trying to explain their story. But I don't think it would be very far-fetched to believe that these people are likely threatened with violence, threatened with more dangerous acts if they try to get their story known. And indeed, as Mr. Fryer said, the problem is that many of these people, after a while, probably just gave up trying to complain about it in general, because what's the point of trying to get your story out if you know the lid will be trying to, they will try to put the lid on it constantly. And that result is that, fortunately, we have had some good journalists now, Australian journalists, who have finally decided to publish the story. But it will, of course, it has taken years for these people to dig through the mud in order to get what they needed in order to publish this report. That's the result of it.
Right. And Jonathan, at the end of the day, do you think that any measures will really be taken against these soldiers? Will these soldiers be charged with murder, you think?
Well, I think certainly there will be prosecutions, whether they will be found guilty and sentenced to long periods of prison is another matter. But I think there certainly will be prosecutions. It would be very difficult for the Australian government to avoid putting some troops on trial because of the public opinion and international opinion, which would demand that some people have to bear responsibility. As I mentioned earlier, the problem is how high up the line should this go? Because obviously the higher it goes, then the less likelihood there is of any proper retribution against the people who are responsible for the policy, which does stem into the whole of the war on terror narrative. In other words, that if you're in a situation where you're dealing against with terrorists, that anything goes, and that means that ordinary civilians who probably have nothing whatsoever to do with any extreme group get caught up in this. So I think it's very important for international law that Australia takes a stand and that other countries, including Britain, also look at their own special forces and really see whether this problem is wider and whether how it can be rooted out.
Well, Brett, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison now has apologized directly to Afghan President Ashraf Ghani about what he called these abuses. But what does that mean at the end of the day? What do you think is going to happen?
Of course, the problem is that it's very easy to apologize for something that happened. The question here is, of course, if you not just, you know, talk the talk, but also walk the walk. And that's something that Australia has to prove now. They have to show to the world that they take this seriously, that these people will be tried for the crimes that they have committed. And indeed, this in many cases, this would definitely include the charge of murder or at least manslaughter, and not just, you know, crimes that not just like abuses that were committed in the time of war. Because that makes it sound like there are circumstances that would justify these actions. And I don't think these things are justifiable, no matter under which circumstances they happen. The other problem, of course, is the question remains how far Afghanistan, the government of Afghanistan, will go in order to pursue this. Because we have seen time and again that the Afghan government is not always necessarily a stable government and is in many cases and in many ways very dependent, of course, on these foreign troops that are keeping it in power. There is a very often problem of popular support that is very much lacking, popular support for this government. And as a result, it is very difficult, I think, for the it is very unlikely, I mean, for to hope that these Afghan politicians will really try to pressure what they perceive as their Western allies into really pursuing this very much. Of course, I could be mistaken, and I hope I will be. But this goes much further than just apologizing and saying sorry that this happened. These people have to be brought to justice. Recompensation should be paid to the families of the victims. And in general, actually, recompensation should be paid to Afghanistan, because this is running into their hundreds of billions of dollars that Afghanistan has been suffering in both economic terms and, of course, in manpower and in population. A lot of people that have been massacred as a result of this unnecessary war ever since 2001. Mm-hmm. So this is a general problem that has to be solved in a way that is much more fundamental. And that is something in which I fear that is unlikely to happen, because if we bring it back to the leader of this coalition, the United States, we have to bear in mind the United States has never even recompensated Vietnam for the crimes they have committed there 40, 50 years ago. So right. the chances that they could do this anytime soon to Afghanistan are, I'm afraid, quite slim.
Well, Jonathan, are there double standards in the way U.S. allies are held responsible for war crimes as opposed to those fighting against the U.S.?
Well, I mean, a war crime is a war crime, whoever carries it out, whether it's the U.S. or any of their allied forces in a country like Afghanistan, or any extremist group. In the news bulletin, you mentioned today's attacks from Daesh on Kabul, again, yet more civilians killed in that attack. And certainly they need to be held to account as well, but it's much more difficult because, of course, you can't often identify where is the chain of command and who are really carrying out these atrocities. But the whole idea of setting up the International Criminal Court several years ago, which Trump so dislikes, is the idea that there are international standards, and these should apply to governments, to armies, and to non-state actors. And it's very important, I think, that this principle be bolstered by appropriate judicial action, and that the climate of impunity in a war situation is removed, because surely in the 21st century we should have realized that it's no longer possible to justify many things which perhaps our ancestors considered perfectly normal, but which we don't.
Which we don't. What do you think about that, Brett? Things that ancestors didn't consider normal, but which we don't. However, if we look at the world of 2020 and we see the imbalance of it all, how much have we progressed? When we look at this situation, at the end of the day, Don't you think, according to international standards, that the life of an Afghan is not going to be held the same as for as an American soldier being killed or an Aussie soldier being killed or a Brit being killed on the ground? Isn't there a difference when we see terrorist attacks and how we react when they're committed in Afghanistan as opposed to a terrorist attack in Europe or some of these other Western countries?
Yeah, this is, I believe that is undeniably true. There is a massive amount of hypocrisy in general, in international media, mainstream media mostly, in international politics. Even in international diplomacy, there is a massive issue that we have, what we have seen over and over again, that when a terrorist attack happens, for example, in Brussels or in Paris, this is worldwide news. This goes on that to dominate world politics for years sometimes, whereas these sort of attacks that have been taking place, for example, in Paris, they happen on a weekly basis in some areas in the Middle East, for example, and in many cases those same sort of attacks of that magnitude are being committed by the Western powers that are mourning the attacks that are taking place in the West. Now, the problem is that there is this indeed this massive double standard that unfortunately has seeped very much into the ICC as well. The ICC has been doing definitely some good work ever since it was founded, undeniably so. But there is as well an undeniable focus on certain third world leaders and certain third world countries. There is a reason why in some regions of Africa, the ICC is jokingly called the International Caucasian Court, because it's something that it's a court that is perceived as a very Eurocentric court that specifically targets leaders of in Africa mostly, or in Yugoslavia, be leaders of third world countries, of countries that are not part of the hegemonic powers, and that these people, for their crimes or perceived crimes, are being dragged to The Hague in order to be tried. But it's very almost unheard of to see this pressure, the same sort of status, the same sort of rules being applied to people and rulers of first world countries. For example, you know, George W. Bush. For example, the crimes committed by President Obama, who even received the Nobel Peace Prize right before he went on to, you know, murder people in Syria and in Libya. So this is there is a massive hypocrisy at play here that is embedded in a way, of course, in the United Nations, very often in the veto power being wielded by certain permanent members of the Security Council.
All right. And on that note, so sorry to interrupt you, but we are out of time. I appreciate both of you being with us, author and lecturer Jonathan Fryer out of London, journalist and historian Brett Yonkers out of Hazzard. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The Epic of 8-Year Holy Defense.
In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed the admission of the Western and Arab media and regimes under all-out support for the Iraqi dictator Saddam during the 8-year war he had imposed on the Islamic Republic of Iran upon the order of his masters in Washington and then Moscow. Stay tuned for more, please. The French intelligence agencies estimated in 1986 that if Paris had stopped sending aids to Iraq for 3 weeks, the Iraqi army would have been defeated in the war. As the United States, the Soviet Union, and their satellites had imposed the war on Iran to overthrow the Islamic system, they didn't spare any assistance to the Ba'athist regime in financial, arms, and political terms. This while they even refused to sell barbed wire to Iran. The US and European regimes, especially France, Britain and Germany, delivered enormous amounts of chemical weapons to Saddam, which he used both against the Iranian combatants and a few towns. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, as the president of Iran in those days, would often go to the battlefronts since the first days of the war. He says on the end of the 8-year holy defense, during the imposed war that lasted for 8 years, the US helped Saddam. NATO helped Saddam. The Soviet Union of those days helped Saddam. The reactionary Arab bloc, though it was very incompetent and weak, helped Saddam. Everyone helped Saddam. I mean, the East and the West had formed a single front for Saddam and against the Islamic Republic. Yet, the Islamic Republic didn't turn a hair. It stood and, with the divine help, overcame all of them and triumphed over all of them. After 8 years of war, they couldn't separate one span of Iran's soil. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, analyzing the Iranian people's exemplary steadfastness during the 8-year holy defense, says, "The Americans' aim of imposition of the war was to defeat the Islamic Republic by Saddam, to cause it to lose its reputation and say, yes, the Islamic Republic government and the Islamic Republic system caused Iran to lose. But the contrary occurred. In all the wars of the past 200 years with another country, Iran had lost. Yet, this 8-year war is the first war and the only war that Iran has defeated the other side and has not lost. A single span of the soil has not fallen in the hands of the foreign country. This is the first war, quite opposite to what Americans had desired took place." James Beall, a specialist of the issues of West Asia, says in his book on the war that the Iraqi regime hoped that it could nip the Iranian revolution in the bud. The Ba'athist army had invaded Iran's borders 636 times before the outbreak of the war on September 22, 1980. Saddam initiated the invasion of Iran, saying that he would reach Tehran within 3 days. He waged an all-out war with 12 infantry divisions, 15 armed brigades, 4,500 tanks and personnel carriers, 360 jet fighters, and 400 helicopters, as well as full military equipment. Contrary to his wishful thinking, his criminal army was bogged down as it faced the stiff resistance of the valiant people of Khorramshahr for 35 days. Although the Iranian army had little coherence in those days, and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps had been established for less than 1 year and a half, the national unity among all walks of life helped people overcome difficulties little by little. One year after the invasion of Saddam's criminal army, Iran changed its strategy from defensive to offensive so that within 9 months, big swathes of occupied territories were liberated and Saddam's regime sustained crushing defeats. Without any doubt, the most important reason for those victories was the unmatched leadership of the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him. Imam Khomeini's words and commandments were highly esteemed among people, especially the youth. There was a very profound bond between the Imam and the Ummah. This was the very matter that the enemies had neglected and, in fact, couldn't understand. Former head of the French spying agency, Comte de Morange, said on how much the West was scared of the Imam's leadership. Iran is one of the real powers of the region as it has huge oil reserves in its vast and populous territory. For thousands of years, this empire has been known as the dominant power in the entire region. Now, in the era of Ayatollah Khomeini, this power has multiplied manifold. The French official wrote in a message to Saddam, "As for this man, Imam Khomeini, be alert. Nothing is more dangerous than a forest that has caught fire, because strong winds will blow over it and the fire can spread to the intellectual borders and neighboring countries." The United States and its European and regional allies considered Iraq as the best choice for achieving their nefarious goals. The Iraqi Prime Minister in those days, Taha Yassin Ramazan, said, "This war is not for the 1975 Algiers Accord or several kilometers of land and half of Arvand River. This war is aimed at toppling the Islamic Republic regime." Lars Aspin, then head of the Armed Forces Committee of the American House of Representatives, also stressed that the U.S. strategic objective should be focused on stopping the expansion of Iran's radical Islamic revolution to the Arab world, even if it requires employment of military force.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.